My name is Deborah Wai, and I'm the Chief Curator of Prints here at the Museum of Modern Art, and I'm the organizer of the Kirchner exhibition. I want to thank you all for coming and to thank our six speakers for their presentations today, and also add my own personal thanks to them because their scholarship in the field is so outstanding. It's been an inspiration to me and helped shape my own thinking about the Kirchner Street Scene series. My ideas about the series are encompassed in the exhibition and catalog, so I won't talk more about my own feelings about them. But there was something that I wanted to present at the beginning, just so we all have the same understanding of what the Street Scene series actually consists of. We don't know this for sure from Kirchner's point of view. As far as I know, there's no list that he wrote of what encompasses the series, and there was no exhibition in which he launched the group of works as a series. But in 1993, the art historian Magdalena Mola published a study which constituted her ideas of a catalog raisonné of the Street Scene series. And this consisted of paintings as well as works on paper. And she proposed 11 paintings in the Street Scene series. And upstairs in the exhibition, I've pulled together 7 of these works. And I pulled them together for what I considered a certain coherence. So I wanted to talk about the 11 paintings, just so you understand what scholars over the years have been talking about in terms of the Street Scene series. Again, I mentioned that I brought my 7 together for what I considered a certain unity in terms of imagery and also scale and orientation. The imagery of the 7 in the show focus on women as the main protagonists, large women. The paintings are all in a vertical format. All but one are about 4 feet tall, so they're similar in scale. And they all have a kind of confrontational sense to them. Also, even though all the titles refer to the streets of Berlin in one way or another, the details of the city are kept just at the peripheral parts of the canvases. And you'll see a wheel of a vehicle here. This is a store window that this person is looking into. Here is a vehicle. You see a man climbing on. It's a horse-drawn vehicle in the background. So even though these are supposed to be the streets of Berlin, you can hardly tell that, except for one exception, and I'll show you that painting. So these are 2 of my 7. This is the exceptional one, which is larger. It's about 6.5 feet tall, and it does locate you in a particular place in Berlin, and that's Potsdamer Platz. So it's the only painting where you really see the environment so clearly. 2 more, and then the final 2 to make 7 in all. But this is an example of another painting that's part of the Street Scene series. And it was painted at the same time, 1914, it's thought. But about 11 years later, Kirchner went back to work on this painting again in 1925. And at that point, his style had changed. And so the painting is overpainted in a way that I think tamps down a lot of the initial energy and nervousness that would have been in the initial painting. And you can see the flat, broad areas of color in this particular work. But also, it seems more or less to me like an everyday scene of pedestrians in the middle of the city, not this kind of anxiety-ridden, explosive feeling of the prostitutes confronting you on the city streets. So I think it feels like a much more, nice scene rather than a more dangerous one. But I wanted to put up aside a pastel that we have in the show on the right. The pastel was not retouched in any way, and I made it larger. It's actually only 16 inches tall, so it's tiny compared to the painting. But I wanted you to be able to compare the details. So you see in the pastel, all this nervous brushstroke. The men here seem rather threatening in the background, so does this character. And the woman is so angular and tensed up and nervous-looking, almost like an insect. It has a very different feeling from the painting on the left. This is another street scene, Leipziger Strasse, with tram from the same period. But this, I hope you can tell, is very different in the sense that it's really a kind of anecdotal view or a panoramic view of the city. This is the tram. There's some people lined up to take the tram. These are just bright streetlights here, these white things. But this is the architecture of the city. There is a group here, and the first two people in the group do look like the streetwalkers, and there are men behind them with the derby hats. But this has a very different feeling from the vertical paintings in the seven works that I chose. And then finally, there are these two rather odd paintings. They're small. They're a little over 2 feet high compared to the 4 feet size of the paintings in the series that we're talking about. And the one on the right is thought to be definitely overpainted in the 20s, the early 20s, and it's flattened out in the way that the red woman in the red dress was flattened out. I think you can see that. The one on the left is problematic in other ways. There's a kind of odd part of her dress right here. I think these paintings really deserve a lot more study. I think they could be very interesting in relationship to the series as a whole, but clearly different. But I wanted to show you the one on the left in comparison to MoMA's street scene painting. Both of these small paintings are of the same subject matter. And you see a main figure here with her companion. And you see a car here and a car here. And you see this man looking into the window right here. I would propose that these small works were actually oil sketches studies that probably belong more with the pastels and other works on paper that were done as Kirchner evolved the street scene paintings. And they're actually precisely the same size as the large pastels. And we have two of them in the show that were very close to the paintings, and that's Friedrichstrasse and the Potsdamer Platz pastels. They're quite close to the finished paintings, and it's curious to me that these are just the same size as those pastels. So I don't know if oil sketches were part of his works in relationship to the street scene studies as well. Again, this is just an idea I have, so I haven't looked into it seriously. But I wanted us all to have the same understanding of what people talk about when they talk about the street scenes. So now we'll turn to our first presentation, and I'll introduce Reinhold Heller as our first speaker. And in your program, you have biographies of all these speakers, so I won't go into that, and that will save us time. So welcome, Reinhold. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Debbie. My presentation today is unabashedly biographic. It is also what I like to think of as a kind of art historical cake or cake recipe. If baking a cake seems to you like a strange way to approach Ernst Ludwig Kirchner's remarkable group of paintings of Berlin's street scenes, I invoke the excuse of biological determination. I cannot do otherwise. I descend from a family of bakers. My father was a master baker and confectioner in Germany. An art historical Kirchnerian cake, therefore, seems very much appropriate. Accordingly, I will be using a recipe that takes portions of biographic information, mixes in broadly contextual information, and then bakes. I begin my Kirchnerian cake with the Berlin street scenes as the main ingredient. They comprise a series of some 11 paintings, as Debbie just told you. Kirchner overpainted some and others did not fit conceptually, again, as was reviewed for us just now, so that the exhibition now consists of 7 paintings. The entire series of paintings was produced in the space of a little more than a year, from the late fall of 1913 to the early winter of 1914-15. Think about that, please. In less than 14 months, Kirchner painted the entire monumental series of paintings. He produced innumerable drawings and prints in varied media and sizes, devoted to the street scene theme as well. Even if we think only of the physical and psychic strength and energy necessary to achieve the images, and if we disregard such issues as artistic intention, artistic creativity, or artistic quality, by any measure, Kirchner's involvement with the street scene motifs represents a stupendous act of explosive artistic creativity. It is further remarkable and significant that Kirchner worked on the paintings essentially simultaneously. From late autumn 1913 until the winter of 1915, in Kirchner's Berlin studio, always at least one and most likely several street scenes were in progress and probably on display. The street scenes were for Kirchner a daily, constant, imposing and demanding presence. When we consider as well the large size of most of the paintings and the numerous drawings and prints associated with them, then we should recognize that for Kirchner, the street scenes represented an unprecedented major commitment of time, energy, space, and material and economic resources to a single coherent series of works. There's nothing like that previously in his oeuvre. In 1913, when he initiated this project, Kirchner had been an artist for roughly 10 years. During those 10 years, Kirchner neither produced nor attempted a project as ambitious as the street scenes, nor did he seem to think in their multi-image serial terms. During the decade from 1903 to 1913, nothing anticipates the street scene series in ambition. Viewed in this context, the paintings are a veritable anomaly in Kirchner's career. Alternatively, they proclaim a fundamentally altered and transformed artist, a new artist, not the Kirchner of the prior years. To re-inject my baking metaphor, the cake of the street scenes employs a new recipe, one that had not been tasted previously. Allow me briefly to review how our artist baker Kirchner worked prior to 1913. It is a well-known history, but I want to refresh our memory quickly to let us remember its recipe and its taste before we continue to indulge ourselves in the street scene grandiose cake that is on exhibition here. Kirchner, as we all know, was one of the founders of Germany's first group of expressionist artists, the Brücker, in 1905 in Dresden. He was joined in this effort initially by three other artists, Fritz Bleil, Erich Heckel, and Carl Schmidt-Rottluff. Bleil resigned some years later, and in the meantime, Max Pechstein entered the group. Influenced by French post-impressionist painting, and most notably by Vincent van Gogh, Edvard Munch, and Henri Matisse, the group of Heckel, Kirchner, Pechstein, and Schmidt-Rottluff together evolved a highly charged figurative expressionist painting, graphics, and sculptural style. As two or more of them worked together frequently, and as they exhibited together under the collective name of the Brücke, the principle of communal interaction and communal identity dominated. Art history, indeed, has identified a coherent Brücke style that matured around 1910, as we can well recognize through the stylistic and thematic kinship represented by these paintings, these three paintings by Heckel, Kirchner, and Pechstein. painted as the trio of artists spent the summer of 1910 in the verdant surroundings of the Moritzburg ponds near Dresden. Individual painting vocabularies cease being primary in order to be subsumed into a communally shared approach, as well as shared subject matter and shared experience. For Kirchner, this utopian principle of a harmonious community was extremely important. The individual should be contained or embraced within a new communal entity in order to foster a new art, a new communal style of the time. The principle underlay his efforts beginning in 1903 to bring together other artists in his studio so they could share in the creative process. And it was the primary founding concept of the Brücke Group in 1905, as is apparent in its program, this principle of bringing together all youth, as the program proclaims. The desire for community, in other words, cannot be overemphasized. However, it appears that this sense of communal cohesion did not survive the departure of the artists from Dresden late in 1911, when they moved to Berlin to further their art in the German imperial capital. The cause and effect relationship that I posit here certainly oversimplifies the situation, but nonetheless, after they settled in Berlin, the Brücke's sense of communal identity rapidly dissipated. In May 1913, the group officially announced that it no longer existed and declared itself dissolved. Usually, Kirchner is thought to have precipitated the breakup of the group with his Chronicle of the Brücke. At least those are the recollections of Heckel and Schmidt-Rottluff, although here too oversimplification and the selectivity of public memory certainly play a major role. Kirchner, on the other hand, blamed Max Pechstein and significantly excluded Pechstein from this idyllic memorial portrait of the Brücke group that Kirchner painted in 1926-27. Wherever we may affix the blame for the dissolution of the Brücke, after the summer of 1913, little remained of the friendship that once bound them all together. Initially, there were brief visits to Kirchner and surely in Berlin repeated encounters, but any close cooperation or mutual support was now totally absent. Indeed, Kirchner quite consciously avoided contact with his former Brücke colleagues until well into the 1920s. Instead, he accused the others of stealing his ideas and imitating his work. Whatever the value of Kirchner's accusations may be, or to what degree they manifest the deep uncertainty of paranoia, each of the Brücke artists now set out to foster individual careers, competing directly with their former colleagues. As early as the fall of 1913, just a few months after the dissolution of the Brücke, each artist technically organized extensive one-man exhibitions in Berlin and in other German cities. The prior group ideal of exhibiting together collectively was totally rejected. Their one-man exhibitions clearly posited separation and uniqueness, distinction rather than community. Competition became the operative principle, not cooperation or collective identity. In the metaphor of our cake batter, for the Brücke, all the ingredients in 1913 curdled and separated. The only alternative left was to start over with new ingredients. Judging from Kirchner's surviving letters, the failure of the Brücke affected him more severely than it did the others. More than they, he felt personally betrayed. his utopian project of forming a collective new art and culture, a project in which he fervently believed had been rejected. And he considered himself friendless, isolated, under attack, and besieged. As he recalled in 1919, the years 1911 to 1914 were one of the loneliest times of my life, during which a torturing unrest drove me out into the long streets filled with people and wagons day and night. Kirchner viewed himself as alienated while surrounded by people, again following recollections from 1919, in which he wrote, "I was always alone. The more I went out among people, the more I felt loneliness, felt excluded, although no one excluded me. That causes deep sadness, and this disappeared only in my work and through my will. As I learned to be invisible by means of self-denial, I saw all the lonely people. All of them touch each other and are invisible. Pure willing results in loneliness, desire subsides, and behind material reality appears actual reality. One must be invisible in order to see." It is not difficult to imagine why today art historians and critics like to cite these particular statements as being reflected in the moods and tone of the street scene paintings, which are often, as we now know, viewed as images of, among other things, urban isolation and angst. However, it is difficult to match Kirchner's feelings of utter abandonment with what we know of his life in Berlin between 1911 and 1914. Which actually was less a time of isolation than it was a time of restless activity, of new social and new intense personal contacts. Indeed, even as the Brook of Friendships ended, Kirchner formed an extensive new network of friends among Berlin's numerous artists and writers, patrons and supporters. He also met Erna Schilling, who became his faithful companion and loyal partner until the end of his life. Insofar as loneliness was a complaint for Kirchner in 1913, it was generated while he was surrounded by people and activity. It was the insufficiency of these that were his problem, Kirchner believed. And again I quote, "Who is there that can give me something, who offers me inspirations and new ideas? I must create them myself, out of my fantasy, out of my own thoughts." It's a quote from 1925. And several months later, he reformulated this perception of absolute, imposed independence even more radically. "Do I have a home? No, I am an outsider here, an outsider there. There is no one who wants me. Alone, alone with my art." Now, as we listen to Kirchner, we certainly hear more than an overtone of self-pity, but even more we should recognize the mighty influence of Friedrich Nietzsche. Kirchner's vocabulary of the lonely struggle of the will is clearly Nietzschean in origin, and it is mixed as well with aspects of the long-standing cult of the suffering, isolated artist genius. In part, at least, Kirchner's complaints of loneliness and rejection in 1913 formulate an overt effort to construct a modernist artist mythology. Kirchner was shaping his new self for himself, his new post-Brücke artist persona. In terms of my cake metaphor, once the prior Brücke batter curdled, separated, and failed, Kirchner turned to new ingredients for a different cake. Now, rather than beat this batter too much, making my lecture cake tough and inedible, I want to point point out simply, or posit simply, that the street scene paintings were a major ingredient of Kirchner's new identity recipe, designed especially to distinguish him from his former colleagues. Again, I want to remind us that Kirchner painted this grouping of monumental paintings in just over a year, beginning just a few months after the breakup of the Brücke and ending shortly before he entered military service in 1915. Two extraordinary traumatic events that impact Kirchner's life decisively therefore form existential brackets around the painting of the street scenes. The temporal proximity of the street scenes to the breakup of the Brücke in May 1913 offers a compelling linkage between the two biographically. Kirchner spent the summer months of 1913 on the North Sea island of Fehmarn, accompanied by his new beloved from Berlin, Anna Schilling, whom we've seen previously in a photograph and here in a painting. He was visited by Otto and Maschka Müller and by two former students of the art school that Kirchner and Pechstein had briefly set up in 1911-12. These were the sole Brücke-related contacts of the summer. Retrospectively, by 1925, Kirchner viewed the Fehmarn summer of 1913 as a time when he completed projects remaining from the Brücke years and thus artistically definitively terminated that period in his life and work. And in 25 he wrote, "Here I learned how to construct the essential unity between human being and nature, and I completed what I had begun in Moritzburg. My colors became milder and richer, the forms more severe and more distanced from the given forms of nature." But in another text in 1925, which he wrote in the third person, he also identified a creative loneliness existentially akin to what he would describe as possessing later in Berlin. And I quote, "The loneliness of the island releases a mystical sensation in my relationship or in his relationship to his wife. He attained the capacity to view and depict himself as like a third person." If we can place any credence in these recollections, the preparation psychologically for the Berlin street scenes took place, ironically, on the island of Fehmarn in the summer of 1913, as Kirchner exalted in the idyllic harmony of man and nature, and as he closed the Brücke chapter of his life. Returned to Berlin, Kirchner entered into a flurry of activity. He organized two major retrospective exhibitions. He also moved his studio into new quarters, leaving behind yet another relic of his Brücke associations, that is his first Berlin studio, which was housed where Pechstein too had his studio. This is a view of Kirchner's second Berlin studio. Arranging and organizing exhibitions and moving into a new living and working space were both extraordinarily disruptive and potentially disorienting experiences. They were rejuvenating, reinvigorating experiences, announcing new beginnings as well. Within the physical and psychological turmoil of these activities, moreover, Kirchner then initiated the ambitious project of the street scene paintings. They appear in a time when Kirchner was coming to terms with the breakup of the Brücke and was responding to it by redefining himself dramatically as person and as artist. The street scenes both reaffirm the termination of the Brücke and serve as a resurrection for Kirchner as artist. Now, it is difficult for us today to determine if Kirchner initially thought of this as a multi-image project, as a kind of multipartite unity. His sketchbooks show Kirchner picking up the motifs of several of the paintings simultaneously, indicating that he worked on multiple paintings at the same time, as I already noted. The repeatedly intermingled sketchbook images may indeed also imply an original multi-image concept, the idea of creating a series of paintings of the street theme rather than just one. Because it is with the creation of such a series of interrelated monumental representations of the mundane urban street from the viewpoint of one of the passers-by, from the viewpoint of a member of the very urban anonymity being depicted, that Kirchner definitively broke with the pictorial world of his former Brücke colleagues. For now, we can ignore the issue of prostitutes and their representation. I think it will be taken up by others following me. These issues, which figure so prominently in the critical and historical evaluation of these paintings today. It is less the prostitutes and more the street itself in multiple views that distinguishes Kirchner's image from those of the other Brücke artists. We today identify Kirchner with representations of the modern city. A survey of the work of the other Brücke artists quickly shows that this is not the case with their work. Otto Müller, by whom you see a painting here, never turned to the city milieu in which he lived in Berlin for his motif. The same can be said for Carl Schmidt-Rottluff, although he did depict the streets of Dresden previously and in 1912-13 transformed segments of Hamburg into his vibrant colors. To Berlin, however, he was blind. For Max Pechstein, Kirchner's arch-villain, representations of the city are an anomaly, not a defining motif. When the city does appear, it is in terms of its peripheries, where nature and urban construction collide. Only Erich Haeckel turned to the city with any consistency, but, again, in ways unlike Kirchner. Haeckel tended to depict the city either as a dehumanizing amalgam of anonymous constructions that block out the sunrise in the upper left, or, ironically, Haeckel's city offered itself respite from itself in picturesque parks and gardens that masked the surrounding environment of modern urban life. For all the former Brücke artists, other than Kirchner, as a motif in their works, the city was at best incidental. And their city imagery lacked the complexity of Kirchner's. Now, I just tossed together a bouquet of ingredients into my cake recipe. It's time to see what our batter looks like. We know that Kirchner repeatedly identified the paintings, the street paintings, as a major achievement of his career. We saw that he initiated the series shortly after the breakup of the Brücke, and that it could define him as an independent artist, free from group association. Moreover, the scope of the city street series, with its monumental images unified thematically and innovative stylistically, knows no equal in ambition or extent among the other Brücke artists and probably also among other contemporary German artists. The street scenes, notably as a unified serial grouping, were a unique achievement. Their collective artistic unity replaced the communal unity Kirchner previously hoped to realize with the Brücke group. Now, we have mixed our batter and have a uniquely Kirchnerian street scene cake, I believe. Surprisingly, then, Kirchner never ate it. What we see in the exhibition here is something that Kirchner never saw. The street scene paintings were never exhibited together as a unit by him. He never made public the project that could define his unique position within the German art community, and instead exhibited and sold the paintings separately, individually. Now, why bake a cake and then not eat it or let others eat it? The question, I believe, still lacks a compelling answer.
Thank you, Reinhold. I noticed in my program that the timings are a little off, and each speaker will speak approximately 20 minutes, and we'll catch up at the coffee break, which will start at 2:15, I think, instead of 2:10. So, Sherwin Simmons, thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. On November 26, 1863, Charles Baudelaire published the first section of a three-part essay entitled The Painter of Modern Life in Figaro, the Paris newspaper. Focused on the work of Constantin Guy, Baudelaire celebrated what he famously termed the ephemeral, the fugitive, the contingent found there. Since that time, art historians have repeatedly addressed the prescience of Baudelaire's essay, the way it anticipated and articulated the new artistic values that were soon manifested more broadly in French Impressionist painting. In previous discussions of Ernst Kirchner's street paintings, particularly Mark Haxthausen's groundbreaking article of 1990, the series has been related to this French Impressionist tradition that affirmed and found new expressive forms for the dynamic and fragmented character of modern urban life. In my paper this afternoon, I will suggest that part of the ambition of the street series was Kirchner's desire to insert himself as a German artist into that tradition. As I've stressed in a previous article, the street paintings were done at a moment when many voices in Germany were claiming Berlin's equality with Paris as a Weltstadt. Likewise, there were calls for artists to learn from Paris in order to create an artistic culture equal to German achievements in other fields. The French tradition of the painting of modern life was well known in Germany, both in the numerous strong private collections that were assembled at the turn of the century, and eventually in public museums, which benefited from the generosity of those private collectors and the wisdom of powerful museum directors. Thus, for example, each of these paintings by Monet, overviews of the dynamic space of Paris, were on public view in Germany during the mid-first decade of the new century. Very quickly, the works of the post-impressionists were equally available, to such an extent that, as Aya Soika has discovered, Max Pechstein wrote to a friend shortly after arriving in Paris in December 1907 and related that he had been told that he needed to return to Germany in order to study the great French artists. Given the prevailing construct of national identity, however, such active interest in French art eventually created a public scandal. When Gustav Pauli, the director of the Bremen Kunsthalle, purchased Vincent van Gogh's Field of Poppies in 1910 with the strong encouragement of Alfred Walter Heimel and other sophisticated collectors, there was a growing protest led by Carl Vinnen, a Vorpsweide painter and former member of the board of the Kunstverein in Bremen. He eventually published A Protest of German Artists, a booklet in which 123 artists and critics supported his charge that the purchase of large numbers of French paintings for extravagant prices hurt the development of German art,
as seen in the 1910 Sonderbund exhibition in Dusseldorf, where the most recent French excesses, as represented by the Fauves, seem to be followed by young German artists, Kirchner among them. The answer to the protest of German artists, a booklet edited by Heimel, was soon published, in which 85 artists and art writers stated their support for Pauly and explained the need for German artists to engage with the French modernist tradition. Response was also found in the Sonderbund exhibition, which opened in Cologne in May 1912 and constituted the largest and most comprehensive exhibition of post-impressionist art yet held in the world. French artists were found in the rooms to the left of the central axis, German and other nationalities in rooms to the right. The four central rooms contained 108 works by Vincent van Gogh, while the room at the rear was conceived as a modern German chapel with stained glass by Johann Thorn Pricker and the murals by Kirchner and Erich Heckel. These perhaps indicate a desire to find a distinctly German voice within international modernism, but it doesn't mean that engagement with the latest developments of French art ceased. In fact, in the years before the war, German collecting and exhibiting of French art only intensified, with major shows of the most recent work by Matisse and Picasso. There were also important retrospectives, such as classical French painting in the 19th century, organized by the Frankfurter Kunstverein during summer 1912, and a similarly large exhibition held at the Arnold Gallery in Dresden shortly after exhibitions in January 1914 at the Richter Gallery of 82 works by Picasso accompanied with examples of African sculpture, and at the Arnold Gallery of 160 works by German and Austrian expressionists. While Pechstein would declare his works independence from Cubism and Futurism, in an article of 1912 entitled What is with Picasso, many of his works drew lessons from the paintings of Paul Cézanne, which he saw at the Sonderbund exhibition and other shows during 1912-13. Kirchner would subsequently also declare that he was uninfluenced by Cubism and Futurism. However, close examination of works from 1912 seems to disavow this assertion and shows that the absorption of Cubist and Futurist qualities for his own purposes played a major role in the formal qualities of his street paintings. A critic recognized Kirchner's ongoing response to French art by writing the following words about works that he exhibited at the Berlin Secession in late spring 1913, quote, Kirchner speaks most purely in the harbor landscape, which reminds of Matisse in its strong simplification. However, the pleasant clarity of the French is obvious in comparison. Kirchner still finds it necessary to force things, thereby they are fitted into a scaffolding of lines and colors. Comparison was made very likely to several paintings by Matisse that were shown at the Gerlitt Gallery in May 1913 before continuing on to Russian collections. The word scaffolding, however, alerts us to Kirchner's interest in Cubist pictorial space and formal structure during 1912, possibly that found in a 1909 painting by Georges Braque. Comparison to sketches done from nature makes clear the role played by Braque's painting in connecting surface design with spatial depth. Alfred Flechtheim, working with Wilhelm Uda and Daniel Kahnweiler in Paris, had helped exhibit Braque's painting in Germany, along with many other Cubist paintings, and it had also been reproduced in a Czech magazine in spring 1912. Eleanor Mosman has recently argued convincingly that Kirchner's trip to Prague in summer 1911 played an important role in his introduction to Cubism. extended study of the 7 Braques and 16 Picassos shown at the Sonderbund exhibition in 1912 must have assisted the absorption of Cubist elements into works done on Famarn Island during the summer, as seen not only in the harbor painting, but also in one of the island's main town, a motif that he had treated in 1908 during his first stay on the island. The formal difference between the 1908 lithograph and the 1912 painting, in which the house's planes form a dense and shifting spatial core rising to the church's spire, speaks directly about Braque's contribution to the transformation of his painting style. Even more abstract Cubist works of 1911 had an impact, since they suggested a way to marry his interest in dynamic spatial movement and plunging planes with strong two-dimensional design. This interest had emerged in 1912, particularly seen in Female Circus Rider, in which a reproduction of Seurat's large painting must have served as a stimulus. This is somewhat surprising, since Seurat's work had been little seen in Germany, even though 2 major works, The Models and The Schahut, were in German collections, the first with Count Kessler in Weimar, the second with Richard Goetz, a painter from Ulm living in Paris, who had purchased the work from Meyer Graefe in 1912. On their visits to Goetz's studio, Braque and Picasso admired that work greatly, seeing a relationship to Cubism about which Apollinaire remarked in 1911 and 1913. In Germany, Meyer Graefe had praised Seurat highly in 1904, suggesting that the circus showed the path to a new monumental art, although little more was written in Germany about Seurat. While Flecktheim promised a major book and catalog, Raisonné, by Theodor Doebler, in 1913, it did not appear, although Doebler described Seurat's circus in 1916 as, quote, rolling forth expressionism, tumbling out futurist spirals with yellow-speckled, vivaciously powdered, colored light. Comparison with previous work shows dynamic movement to have been what Kirchner discovered in Seurat, as well as a space synthesized from multiple viewpoints, as Robert Goldwater pointed out in 1941. The latter quality is even more pronounced in a large satin stitch embroidery that Ernest Schilling executed to Kirchner's design in 1912-13. Instead of just the elegant woman in the foreground of the painting, the viewer is joined by the profiles of 3 figures in different scales, who are seated on the near side of the ring. In addition, the female performer, clown, and horse has swollen in size, outgrowing any naturalistic point of view, while the horse's rear is seen simultaneously with its side, producing a spatial distortion expressive of its circular movement in the ring. Finally, of course, the satin stitch embroidery technique materializes the facets in Braque and Picasso's paintings of 1909-10. Kirchner's interest in textile space seems to have played a crucial role in his reception of Cubism, an important aspect of his still life paintings of 1912 that I hope to treat elsewhere. In 1927, Kirchner wrote in his diary about the similar ways that he and Picasso had transformed the representation of the human face, an observation that seems historically rooted in his response to Picasso's Woman with a Black Hat of 1909, which he likely saw in Berlin in spring 1912. Its merger of full face with profile was absorbed during the next year, assisted very likely by Kirchner's discovery of similar spatial effects in Northwest Native American art and Coptic textiles housed in the Imperial Museums. The combined view was then fully displayed in his The combined view was then fully displayed in his 1916 portrait of Oscar Schlemmer, perhaps as a manifestation of that artist's own interest. Thus, it is not surprising that one finds this spatial tension fluidly produced in one of the sketches done on the Berlin street. His apparent simultaneous discovery of that tension in Coptic textiles in 1912 may have something to do with his refusal to credit Cubist painting. However, he certainly put it to work in Five Women on the Street, in which the noses of the right-facing profile are progressively folded back to end with the left-facing profile, which unites with the car's velocity. This device has everything to do with the painting's remarkable somatic kinetic expressiveness, working with the undecidable orientation of the closest figure to create a flipbook-like stutter of figural movement across the surface. Thus I come finally to the street paintings. Did their ambition have anything to do with French art? Perhaps so, if one considers that Degas' Place de la Concorde was shown at the Cassira Gallery in November 1913. Stretching further, consider this description of an artist's drawing, quote, "A master who showed in thousands of hasty sheets how one captures the intensity of faces of the age in the movement of a single stroke, gaining the appearance, the physiognomy, in its characteristic totality." This is a statement by Wilhelm Helgenstein in 1912 about Constantin Guy. But can one make a connection to Kirchner? A question that reader Rita Tauber previously broached. The evidence for Kirchner's relationship to Baudelaire's essay and Guy's work is slim, but I think promising for future investigation. First of all, Kirchner owned this book, Gustave Geoffroy's publication of 1904. Almost 200 pages in length and well illustrated, it emphasized Guy's relationship to Baudelaire and was the most comprehensive study of the artist, being used by subsequent German writers on Guy. The expressionist poets of the Neue Klub, with whom Kirchner associated during 1912-13 in Berlin, were influenced by Baudelaire's poetic vision of urban experience. And when Alfred Döblin published an open letter to Marinetti in March of 1913, he criticized the Italian's writing for ignoring the way Baudelaire allowed himself to be taken over by rhythm and voice that sense of movement in his verse. Such intoxicating formal qualities were also stressed by Julius Meyer Graefe and Helgenstein in their essays about Guy. After ignoring Guy in his developmental history of modern art of 1904, Meyer Graefe devoted a chapter to him in his book Impressionists of 1907. Helgenstein published his essay in 1912. Both books were illustrated with reproductions of works in Heimel's collection, which contained around 80, selections from which were repeatedly exhibited before World War I. Most significant for Kirchner's access to originals is the fact that 50 works by both Guy and Van Gogh were shown at the Arnold Gallery in Dresden in fall 1905. In addition, at least one Guy watercolor was owned by Josef Feinholz in Cologne, who purchased a Kirchner painting from the Sonderbund exhibition in 1912 and later commissioned a mural in felt for a display at the Werkbund exhibition of 1914. Whether there were more works in his collection remains unknown, since his house was totally destroyed in World War II. As a compositional and iconographical type, Kirchner's paintings appear more closely related to Guy than any previous works in the artistic canon. Often focused on one or two fashionable female pedestrians, who seem to draw men to them against vague indications of a city, of a cityscape. Guy was, Meyer Graefe wrote, quote, regarded as the true painter of women between 1850 and 1870. He went on to say that Guy, quote, painted the style of the wife and of the cocotte, with the difference between the two not always being certain. While Geoffroy called him a historian of the Second Empire, Meyer Graefe said that he was better termed its poet, his work being very different from an artist such as Jean Barrault, who could be called the historian of the Third Republic. What mattered for Guy in the motif of the streetwalker was her poetic form, the attraction described by Meyer Graefe in these words, quote, he saw the systematic, the physiology, the naturalism of vice, which is no longer felt as something wicked, but has become habit, character, conviction, and is concerned with the form of this condensed immorality. It gave him no ideas, rather lines, and particularly surfaces, strong tools in order to attribute value to the spatial in its own way. Hausenstein emphasized movement in addition to the spatial, writing, quote, Guy prefers things moving to things not moving, and Impressionism, the art of the instant, is the only adequate expression of things moving. But, he said, what was captured was more than mere movement, rather, quote, something of the social revolutionary psyche of the period twitched uncannily in it. No one defined it exactly, but it was there. And thus the moving thing acquired something from the anxiety of the oversensitive, something of the metaphysical, something bewitching, horrifying, satanic, which a Guy was capable of capturing with his art. Legends made out of the typical was how Meyer Graefe described Guy's larger achievement, which he compared to Velázquez and Rembrandt in the way forms materialize mysteriously within pictorial space and bodies are painted, quote, so that they become apparitions of eternity. Meyer Graefe ended his chapter with this further suggestion about the uncanny in Guy, quote, a touch of melancholy presentiment about the end of the game floats around the pure colors. Guy throws a gray crepe over it. He risks being ugly and thereby magnifies the style. Art prepares itself in him, no longer serves a king. Painters become princes and share the loneliness and misunderstood existence of the great, end quote. Meyer Graefe wrote in 1907, Guy was Impressionist and Greek, and in this very naive way, the archaic period of French art announced itself, end quote. When he revised his remarks as a preface to a deluxe portfolio of reproductions that was published in 1920 and entitled Constantin Guy, Worldly Legends, he described him as, quote, a primitive of a new type, expressionist. His reasons for doing so are unclear, but perhaps his words recognized the way that Guy's subjectivity exceeded Impressionism. When Kirchner made his only recorded statement about Potsdamer Platz in 1925, he stressed the painting's fantasy, a quality he claimed that distinguished German from French art. Pamela Court's recent book about Berlin street scene begins to open our eyes to the way Kirchner sought to overstep the French tradition in the street paintings. Perhaps this can also be seen in Olympia, a painting of 1915 that depicts Erna Schilling reclining and peering from under a coverlet that conceals her body. With the body reversed and the joyous miniature schnauzer behind, it seems a parody of Manet's masterpiece. The strange protruding foot actually connects better with Manet's painting from 1862 of Baudelaire's Mistress, which was in a German collection, and the drawing for which Meyer-Graefe connected to Guy. Similarly, the plum-colored bed and playful animal remind of another work in a German collection, The Reclining Woman in Spanish Costume. However, the painting's rhythm and composition, as well as the eroticism of clothing and concealment, seem to look back to Cranach. Thus, this work's subterfuge, which appears simultaneously coy and brazen, is likely a sign of achieved ambition and a turn away from an engagement with the French tradition. A coda to the street painting's relationship to French art. When Kirchner exhibited Potsdamer Platz with Circus Rider at Berlin's Free Secession exhibition in early 1916, a critic wrote that they should not decorate the walls of a living room. Rather, as symbolic representations of our age, they should become public wall paintings. Of course, this was not Potsdamer Platz's fate, for it's found its way to Hermann Lange's collection in Krefeld. There it was photographed in 1930, hanging on the removable wooden wall that separated the dining room from the reception hall of the house that Mies van der Rohe had designed. It was the first painting work seen as one entered the house. Moving further into the hall, one could begin to see an extensive collection of modern art. Hanging somewhere within was Picasso's Woman with Violin, a high-quality analytical cubist painting of early 1911 that had appeared in the Sonderbund exhibition of 1912. The presence of the two paintings in this collection would have likely pleased Kirchner, for after viewing a series of exhibitions of French art during the mid-1920s, he began to think of Picasso and himself as the leading contemporary masters, holding out an unrealized hope for a joint exhibition at the Berlin Secession in 1929. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Sherwin. And next we have Katerina Henkel. We'll talk about the works on paper. Katerina?
When he moved from Dresden to Berlin in 1911, Ernst Ludwig Kirchner began to devote himself to a completely different subject, namely his new life in the big city. Similarly, he would abandon it again a few years later when he relocated to Switzerland in 1917. It is hardly an exaggeration to say that Kirchner introduced the motif of city life into German art. Certainly, there are among his Berlin works some great icons of 20th century art history. He obviously reacted strongly to his surroundings, and the thematic focus of his work was therefore always on his experience of the world around him. It is hardly surprising, then, that he would explore a motif such as that of the street scenes created between 1913 and 1914 in a variety of media. The year 1913 marks the beginning of Kirchner's street scenes, of which the seven most famous ones are gathered in the current exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art. The earliest of these works is the painting Five Women on the Street, which is owned by the Museum Ludwig in Cologne. When I say the earliest, this is correct in regard to the chronology of the paintings. But as I will show in this lecture, these are often preceded by and developed from works in other media. For some of the paintings, Kirchner evidently produced preliminary sketches. A small number of pastels show that he used this medium to preview possible color combinations. In addition, there are prints, woodcuts, lithographs, and etchings that are closely related to the paintings. Kirchner used these different media, all of which he had mastered perfectly, to experiment and to try out what would later find its final form in the paintings. This does not mean that the chronology of the individual work can in all cases be determined conclusively. Once in his studio, Kirchner would use his much abbreviated drawings within seconds in reaction to things he had seen as a basis for works in different media. I will try to show how all these related works influenced each other and that in producing several versions of a motif, a process of clarification took place. This is not to say, however, that Kirchner made exact preparatory studies for his paintings. Rather, his probing and experimenting in other media later helped him to establish the formal composition of a painting. The several hundred serving sketchbooks suggest that Kirchner always carried one of the small books with a size of around about 8 to 6 inches with him in order to be able to immediately record the situations and people he encountered. While many of the sketches are of individual figures, none of these are identifiable persons, but rather to be seen as types. I've chosen the painting Five Women on the Street as my first example because there exist some quickly drawn sketches as well as two large skin ink drawings and a black and white woodcut that are evidently connected with its origin. The two drawings show very clearly that Kirchner adopted the alignment of the faces and the shape of the heads of the cocottes. Altogether, there exist several thousand drawings of Kirchner. The special status this medium had for the artist is underlined by a programmatic essay from Kirchner himself, followed by two others on his prints and the works he produced later in Switzerland. All three were published by the artist in 1921 under the pseudonym of Louis de Marsal. The first essay emphasizes that to him, drawing was the foundation of all artistic creation. Moreover, it shows that Kirchner considered drawing the most direct and cognitively genuine method of working. It also was the first level of inner absorption and assimilation of reality. But what is this understanding based on? During their earliest years in Dresden, Kirchner and his friends of the Brücke had systematically practiced drawing the nude in brief sessions of only 15 minutes each, before the model would strike a new pose and the artist would change places in order to alter their points of view. The idea behind these self-imposed exercises was to learn to capture the essential aspects of the body within a short time and unfettered by intellectual considerations or even deliberate composition. This method stood in the greatest conceivable contrast to contemporary academic teaching, which focused on representing the model in all detail and as naturalistically as possible. Kirchner was to perfect and use this skill all through the following years and also in Berlin. The difference there was that the people on the street, as well as the artist himself, were constantly on the move during the act of drawing. As he wrote, his method allowed him to capture in drawing what he sees and experiences, to produce without difficulty in lines and forms everything that appears before his inner eye. Deborah Wye has noted that the drawing we have just seen, like the others from the surviving sketchbooks, give the impression that Kirchner had mastered his craft so well that while drawing, he hardly ever needed to turn his gaze from the street to his sketchbook. It should be interesting to view the drawings exhibited here with this in mind. In this context, I would like to introduce two terms that keep recurring in connection with Kirchner's drawings and that he himself had coined: ecstatic drawing and the hieroglyph. Both terms refer to a tripartite process that can be broken down as follows. First, the personal experience of an event, which is the motif. Second, the artistic translation of the experience into drawing, which is the ecstatic drawing. And third, the new and autonomous form within the work of art, which is the hieroglyph. The hieroglyph, as Kirchner understands it, is thus fully independent and precisely not a pale imitation of nature. On the contrary, it might even be the automatic, certainly the autonomously developed artistic equivalent of nature form. By the term ecstasy, the artist means the link that exists between the momentary experience of reality and the autonomous artistic form. The experience of reality can therefore be a stimulus for artistic creation and thus the work of art itself. For Kirchner, art had its roots always in life as he experienced it. But let us return to the five women on the street. The third drawing is already quite close to the later painting in terms of composition. As if for further confirmation, Kirchner made two more large-scale drawings. Both are done in ink. The one on the right is in the Museum Ludwig, on the left, along with the painting itself. The other one on the right is owned by Museum Volkwang in Essen. The woodcut, Five Cocottes, which, according to the catalogue raisonné, was created after the painting, is closest to it, although for technical reasons as mirror image. It would therefore be even more interesting to take a look at the woodblock. Unfortunately, this was destroyed with many others during the fit of depression Kirchner suffered in the last months of his life. The comparison shows that Kirchner adopted almost all the details from the painting in the woodcut. The traffic island, the car, and the woman whose exotic, fantastic appearance fascinates the viewer. Their enormous similarity in posture, movement, clothing, and colorfulness may be perceived as a single form. The three elongated silhouettes of the figures in the center are placed inside a web of acute angle triangles and curves forming a circle. The woman on the left, who is facing the shop window, appears diffuse in its backlighting. The topmost point of the rhombic composition is made up by the head of the cocotte in the background. In the painting, this effect is intensified. Forms and colors are fanned out like plumage. Often, if not in this particular case, the woodcut served to test and clarify form, as the artist tells us. I often had to put the composition through many graphic techniques, especially woodcuts, before I was so sure of it that I could do the painting freely and independently without getting entangled in the correction of details. What is impressive is not least the rendering of details such as the fur collars and stoles, whose haptic qualities are rendered beautifully in both the woodcut and the painting. Notable is also how successfully Kirchner translated the linearity and the shading from the painting into the woodcut, how he managed to unite the apparently incompatible qualities of spontaneity and construction. This is all the more surprising as the hardness of the wood makes it a material difficult to work. Kirchner's ability to make the cuts appear like lightly and spontaneously applied parallel hatching shows his great proficiency in this medium, although, and I quote, "practicing requires much technical skill and interest." But Kirchner's technical ability made woodcutting easy for him. This was written by Louis de Marsal in his essay on Kirchner's graphic works. Usually Kirchner only made 5 to 7 prints from his woodblocks, which bespeaks the artist's awareness of the quality and importance of his work and the singularity of his creative work. Only of about 20 of his woodcuts did he produce around 100 prints, for example, for the yearly portfolio of the Brücke, which were intended for the distribution of the artist's works and thus opening a new market. Another painting for which there can be found related drawings made shortly before or after its creation in 1913-14 is Berlin Street Scene, owned by the Neue Galerie in New York. Here, male figures appear for the first time, the two women with their striking heads and collars painted in red and blue are almost encircled by them. In this context, I would like to read out to you a quote of the appropriate behavior for a cocotte. This term for a prostitute was derived from the French and means little chicken. Robert Hessen notes in the study on prostitution in Germany he published in 1910, "The Berlin police wanted a prostitute walking the streets to be as well-mannered as decent women. The known girl of easy virtue in Friedrichstrasse were under no circumstances allowed to look back, stop before a shop window, or pause their walk with a gentleman, let alone speak to him. I wonder how under these strict conditions any contact was possible at all, especially since the city was full of police informers only waiting for chicken to fall into their traps. A situation as the one depicted in the etching Solicitors from 1914 or in the small piece of metalwood could only take place in public under extreme difficulties. Bordellos, by the way, were forbidden and at least officially did not exist at all, so that for the oldest profession in the world, only the street remained. Although cocottes were not allowed to stop in front of shop windows, Kirchner depicted exactly this situation in both the already discussed Five Women on the Street and the pastel Three Streetwalkers in Front of a Shop Window, both from 1914. After this little detail, let us come back to the painting. In my view, there are five works on paper that must be considered in its context. The first three sketches quite clearly show the constellation of the four figures in the foreground. The horse-drawn tram bearing the number 15 can also just be made out in the background. The electrification of Berlin had begun in 1892, but replacing the old horse-drawn trams with electric ones or buses was a slow process. The sketch in the middle is difficult to read because of its many lines and forms. Here, too, two female figures can be identified. They are recognizable by the feathers on their heads. In the background, you can see, just as in the painting, a group of men. Two large-scale ink drawings show slightly modified versions of the scene, with one woman being besieged by men like a flame by moths. In the left-hand side drawing, the dark male figure in profile on the far right, and the figure stepping into the picture from the left bear a striking resemblance to the painting. Two pastels can also be seen in this context. Especially the one on the left shows a close resemblance between its female protagonist and the right-hand female figure in the painting. The direction of her gaze, her facial features, the cut and color of her dress, and her position in relation to the man on her left are strikingly similar to the painting. At the beginning, I said that for Kirchner, the different media were a means to clarify formal questions for his paintings. Fortunately, a wonderful sketch has survived of the composition of the Berlin Street Scene, of which Kirchner himself explains that it was comprehended in the rhombus of the two heads that is repeated above. The staggered arrangement of the two slightly distorted rhombi gives the impression of three-dimensionality. Kirchner's characteristic changing perspectives can cause irritation, while the woman in the center of the pictures are shown en face at eye level with a viewer. The men in the foreground are seen from above. By choosing different viewpoints for his sketches, Kirchner was able to combine several perspectives. He termed this method that he would then adopt for his paintings Empfindungsperspektive, which means a perspective determined by the personal perception of the scene. Intensely sensual in the greatest simplicity and yet without brutality is how Kirchner describes the forms and colors of his works from the Berlin years. And he elaborates further. I develop them from the vision of movement. For example, the heel of a moving foot will remain in the eye for a moment longer than its tip, which moves constantly, and thus it becomes larger for the picture. I myself move, and thus the single perspective is eliminated. Always right from the start, I was of the opinion that the perceived image of an object looked different from the object itself, and that it is wrong to use one's knowledge of the shapes of objects to correct one's work. The latter can only ever generate a reproduction, never a creative picture. For it is the appearance that fascinates us in nature, not the actual shape and form. The visual arts are concerned with this appearance, not with the nature of real, objective form. Obviously, Kirchner's artistic sensation was always guided by the attraction of movement. This characteristic was intensified by the increasing dynamism of city life at the time. More and more people poured into Berlin looking for work, causing the city to expand in size as well as infrastructure. It is therefore hardly surprising that Kirchner also aimed to capture in his works precisely this bustling activity in the crowded street. The pictorial device of indicating simultaneous movement by arranging several figures in staggered rows is perhaps owned by the artist's desire to make this hectic activity visible in his works. However, it doesn't make its first appearance in 1914 as is often assumed. For example, it can already be detected in the 1912 black and white woodcut, The Canoness in the Garden. This work is one of the series of illustrations of Alfred Döblin's novella, The Canoness and Death, that was published in 1913. Here, the staggered arrangement of the female figure must be interpreted as describing the progress of the canoness walk in the garden. According to Döblin's text, she is alone in the garden where she wants to bury her letters to death. It can therefore be ruled out that the almost identical figures are meant to represent different persons. A much more plausible explanation would be that in this work, Kirchner for the first time tried out the effect of this kind of composition. This compositional approach is illustrated much more clearly in the woodcut Flaneurs on the Street of 1914. Through the repetition of the same figure type on the right, Kirchner enables the viewer to recognize the three gentlemen as one and the same person captured as at different stages of its movement. The moment of entering the picture, of advancing, and finally of passing the oncoming couple. Something similar can be seen in the pastel red Cocotte, the ink drawing Cocotte with the dog, the pencil drawing street scene, and the ink drawing Berlin street scene, all dating from 1914. In the pastel Berlin street scene, but even more in the pastel street scene with green Cocotte of the same year, Kirchner concretizes and condenses the newly discovered stylistic device. However, the painting Street Scene, Friedrichstraße in Berlin, again dating from 1914, must be considered at the height of perfection in regard to this compositional device. The assumption that, like the pastels, the painting shows only the one person is based on the fact that the first eight of the 10 figures look absolutely identical and are marching along the street in steps as if in a revue. Kirchner depicts the element of movement most ingeniously, thus stretching the moment, which literally only lasts for the blink of an eye, to a longer period of time. The movement of the approaching man is experienced as temporal change in space. Consequently, the representation of a sequence of moments necessarily introduces this aspect of time and space into the picture. Kirchner clearly developed his specific understanding of pictorial representation from the reality that provided his artistic stimulus. It became an important principle for him to translate the situation and movements observed into the picture in their entirety. He was not interested in the details that together made up the complete picture, but in the fact that in the act of drawing, everything is shaped by the pictorial dramatization and the logic of the whole. An almost endless number of examples could be invoked as evident on how Kirchner's artistic expression in the different media was interlinked and mutually dependent. I hope I have aroused your curiosity. Perhaps you will even return to the exhibition for another look at the works with the principle practiced by Kirchner in mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Katerina. We're about time for a coffee break now, and we're a little bit off schedule. So I think what we'll probably do is eliminate a second coffee break, which we built into the afternoon, the later afternoon, and proceed to our discussion. And then we'll have a reception afterwards. So I hope everyone will join us for that. So let's say we should be back here at 3:20. Okay, thank you. Get started in a couple of minutes, and I wanted to remind everyone that after the three talks that will follow, we'll have a roundtable discussion, so all the speakers will come up to the front here and ask questions of each other, and we look forward to some questions from the audience as well. And after that, we'll have a reception in the lobby. So you'll have a chance to ask the speakers individual questions and talk to them further. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Charles Mark Haxthausen.
Thank you, Debbie. In a newspaper essay marking the 50th anniversary of the groundbreaking expressionist film, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, the German film critic Frieder Grafe made a provocative observation. I'm showing you here captures from Dr. Caligari. The real authors of the film, she wrote, were the art director, Hermann Warm, and the painters Walter Röhrich and Walter Reimann, who did the sets. The director, Robert Wiener, was not much more than a studio functionary. In the film, Warm was able to realize his concept of film as drawing brought to life. For Grafe, however, there was a fundamental problem with this conception of film, and I quote her. When one senses movement in expressionist paintings, it has to do with the frame, with this arrested movement that threatens to explode it, with the tension between stillness and movement. To animate this kind of painting amounts to eliminating its basis. Just as photography surpassed naturalism, in Caligari, the painting of movement is extended ad absurdum. Grafe made no mention of Ernst Ludwig Kirchner or of any other painter in her short newspaper piece, but her remarks conjured up for me Kirchner's remarkable paintings of urban life from 1913-1915. The years of the Berlin street scenes that are the subject of the current MoMA exhibition, beautifully curated by Debbie Wai. His paintings, more than those of any other artist, exemplify that arrested movement that threatens to explode the frame, the tension between stillness and motion. Grafe's remarks, moreover, call to mind how central the issue of movement was in visual representation of the years before the First World War. One thinks inevitably of the most celebrated examples, the writings of the French philosopher Henri Bergson, the chronophotographs of Étienne Jules Marais, the paintings and sculptures of the Italian futurist, like Umberto Boccioni, Giacomo Balla, and Luigi Russolo, but also of the young medium of cinema, sometimes referred to in these years as Bewegungsbilder, in English, movement images or motion pictures. Kirchner's Berlin paintings are seldom discussed within this context, and that is precisely what I want to do today, hoping to demonstrate that his own approach to this problem was singular and thoroughly original within the pre-war avant-garde, as he produced some remarkable paintings that merit a privileged position within the history of the period. "My painting is a painting of movement," Kirchner wrote in a sketchbook at the end of the 1920s. He elaborated on this declaration in 1930. "I was born near a railway station. The first thing in life that I saw were the locomotives and trains in motion. I drew them when I was 3 years old. Perhaps that is why it is above all the observation of movement that stimulates me to creation. From movement comes the intensified feeling for life, which is the origin of the work of art. A body in movement shows me many different aspects. These fuse within me to a unified form, to an inner image." Given the centrality that Kirchner attributed to the experience and representation of movement in this and other texts, it is surprising that so few commentators have examined this aspect of the Berlin street scenes. Together, the paintings chart a significant development in this regard. Indeed, the series can be seen as a kind of laboratory in which, using a single theme, Kirchner experimented with various pictorial devices for representing and evoking the flux and vitality of urban life. Consistent with Kirchner's statement, motifs that evoke movement are pervasive in his art virtually from the beginning. The dance, the circus, sport, erotically animated bathers, drawn and painted from life, who, to borrow Walt Whitman's inspired phrase, sing the body electric. In the paintings of his early Dresden period, before his move to Berlin, movement may be suggested by Kirchner's motifs as distinct from his formal means, or alternately, by a fluid and rapid execution, especially in his drawings, lithographs, and etchings, or through seizing on intensely rhythmical movements, as in his Panama Girls. These motifs become even more prominent during Kirchner's years in Berlin, where he moved in October 1911. It is there, stimulated by the urban energy of the German capital, that Kirchner responded passionately to the challenge of capturing the dynamism and perpetuum mobile of modern life in a visual medium that was, in contrast to the ascendant and then incipiently respectable medium of cinema, inherently static. We can see such efforts already in paintings done during 1912, Kirchner's first full year in the city. Consistent with his statement, linking his feeling for movement with his childhood drawings of locomotives, one of the ways in which Kirchner sought to evoke movement in his paintings was through the inclusion of vehicles, trams, automobiles, and horse-drawn omnibuses, all of which one can see in this postcard of Potsdamer Platz from the time that Kirchner was painting and drawing the city. We find more trains and trams in his works than in those of any other major artist of his time. Trams appear already in the paintings of his Dresden years, including the first of his street scenes, which is, belongs to MoMA, is on view here. And Kirchner painted automobiles, too. The Austro-Hungarian Georg Lukács wrote in 1913 that not until the cinema had the automobile become poetic, as in the romantic excitement of a speedy auto chase. One of the sensations of the 1913 season was a film by the director Max Mach, Where is Coletti?, which was shot on location in Berlin and included just such chase scenes, in some cases filmed with the camera mounted on a moving vehicle. Kirchner clearly shared this feeling for the poetry of the automobile, including it in his paintings and prints, when nearly all of his contemporaries were still ignoring it. He incorporated various vehicles in five of the eight original figural street scenes, a horse-drawn omnibus in Berlin's street scene there on the left. We can see a man boarding it on the left and the horses on the upper right, a tram in Leipziger Straße, and automobiles in Five Women on the Street, Street Berlin, and Friedrichstraße. I suspect that these were intended to function for Kirchner as signifiers of movement and of the dynamism of the city. In Friedrichstrasse, however, which I reckon to be either fourth or fifth in the sequence of Kirchner's large Berlin street scenes, and which he cited as one of the three he believed most successful, there's something new. The rear section of the automobile that is rolling out of the frame is no longer merely a signifier of movement. Its wheels, by means of their dynamic circular forms, generate movement, releasing a surge of energy into the composition. Their centrifugal force sweeps up the women and men in its current, focusing and intensifying their forward thrust. This movement is reinforced by the parallel curves of the men's legs in the background, which rhyme with the hatchings that are spun off the rotating wheels, and even with the sweeping arc of the curb. One need only compare the painting with the three other Berlin street scenes with vehicular motifs to see the much greater dynamism of Friedrichstrasse. The shift from depicting objects identified with motion to creating movement within the composition by formal means is carried even further in the largest and most ambitious of Kirchner's Berlin street scenes, Potsdamer Platz. This is all the more striking since in Potsdamer Platz there is not a single vehicle to be seen, even though by 1914 the area had supplanted Unter den Linden and Friedrichstrasse as the veritable center of Berlin and was the busiest intersection in the capital, if not in Europe. By 1910, 5,000 trams a day were crossing the square. Might Kirchner have omitted vehicles in this painting because, building on Friedrichstrasse, he had now found a formal means of generating movement within the composition itself, rather than falling back on vehicles as mere signifiers of motion? Certainly the dynamic circular motif assumes even greater prominence in Potsdamer Platz than in Friedrichstrasse. Here we have the traffic island tilted up to such a degree that it is almost parallel to the picture plane. It becomes like a mill wheel, vigorously churning out currents of surface energy. The counterclockwise motion seems propelled by the spiky shoes of the woman in black as it sucks the attenuated legs of the two males traversing the street into its vortex. Kirchner did not limit this dynamic compositional device to Potsdamer Platz. It appears in other paintings and prints of 1914, as you can see here. In the gas tanks with suburban railway on the lower right, the speeding train now becomes isomorphic with the dynamic semicircular arc of the railway, which is reinforced by the ovals of the gas tanks themselves. But the most remarkable of these works, and the most dynamic, is the Circus Rider, a painting which in ambition and scale forms a pendant to Potsdamer Platz. At 2 by 1.5 meters each, they are Kirchner's largest canvases of 1914. As I have written elsewhere, Kirchner has reduced the size of the circus ring and tilted it so drastically that it becomes a vertical plane. Thus it appears not as the ground on which the rider and clown perform, but as a prop in their act, a circular treadmill spun by the horse's hind legs, which seems to push against what is, after all, the sidewall of the arena. Magically, the clown soars above the elegant rider. Working counter to this swirling motion are the curved brushstrokes, producing a counterclockwise eddy that moves against the rightward thrusts of clown and rider with a velocity that appears to distort the features of the spectator on the lower left, producing a powerful churning motion. Kirchner has deployed another important formal device here, which has to do not with the movement of the object, but with the movement of the viewing subject. In a long, undated autobiographical text dating after 1926, he wrote, "One considers a picture to be what one can see from one point in space with a single view. That is a major limitation. This is how I do it. I move and collect the sequence of images within myself to an inner image. This I paint." In other words, Kirchner makes it clear that he is capturing not only the movement of the objects themselves, but is incorporating his own changing relationship to them as he moves through space. As early as 1912, he had been drastically tilting up the ground plane to achieve a taut two-dimensional structure in his paintings. But a comparison between Woman Circus Rider of 1912 on the left and Circus Rider of 1914 clearly shows the difference in approach and in effect. The Woman Circus Rider represents a single viewpoint, adapted to the exigencies of the picture plane. In the later painting, there is not a fixed vantage point. We look straight on at the figure of the circus rider, whose elegant black silhouette evokes Greek black-figured vase painting, even as we seem to be catapulted upward to look down, as though from a lofty trapeze upon the crowd and arena. The dynamism of the whole is enhanced by our seeming to move in space, viewing the scene from drastically shifting perspectives, not merely moving around the motif laterally, as happens in Cubist painting, for example, but vertically, sometimes assuming viewpoints that Kirchner could never have experienced himself. Arguably the richest, most brilliant example of Kirchner's use of multiple viewpoints is his Belle Alliance Platz in Berlin, also of 1914. As you can see, the motif itself, a public square at the southern end of Friedrichstrasse, is entirely level terrain, with a rondelle, or circular park, graced by a Corinthian column crowned by a winged victory commemorating the Battle of Waterloo, in which the Prussians were allied with the British in the defeat of Napoleon. Kirchner has not only tilted the ground plane upwards, emphasizing the circular shape of the rondelle, he has incorporated a number of different viewpoints. We gaze up into the vaulting of the arcade on the right, while we look at the opposite one on the left from a slightly elevated viewpoint. Then we soar sharply upward to look down at the circular plaza, even as the sharp perspecting of the buildings on the far side of the square suggests that we are looking up at them from a position at street level. Kirchner's elevated viewpoint achieves two things here. By tilting the plaza upward, he creates a dynamic circular movement within the painting. But he also creates in his viewers an experience of vicarious movements of their own bodies in space. Kirchner used this multiple perspective to brilliant effect in Potsdamer Platz. Indeed, the painting can seem almost like a composite image, a montage of different views that have been compressed and fused together into a continuum. We can see this more clearly when we look at a photograph of the square, more or less as it looked when Kirchner painted it, and from the street-level perspective from which he would have viewed it. You will see that the tripartite structure of the station facade has been reduced to only its central section and has assumed the reddish color that was apparently present only in the flanking wings. Tightly juxtaposed with this facade was the newest architectural addition to the square, Haus Potsdam, opened in 1912, which included a cinema and the two-story, 2,500-seat Café Piccadilly. Kirchner eliminated the street, Kürtener Straße, that separated the two structures, placing this building cheek by jowl with the central station facade, rhyming the base of its cupola with the shape of the woman's black hat. Below it, while the cityscape is laterally compressed, the beholder's viewpoint is again distended vertically. We encounter the central figure straight on at her eye level. Yet while we look upward to the cupola of Haus Potsdam on the left, as though from street level, as the ground seems to tilt precipitously beneath us, on the right we soar upward to gain an elevated view of the receding street. Again, looking at the Potsdam station in this contemporary postcard makes us appreciate Kirchner's manipulations of space in his quest for generating movement. I've had little to say thus far about an additional factor that gives Kirchner's painting a sense of movement. His long, rapid, often spiky brushstrokes function not merely as an indexical trace of the painting's execution, but inject a directional graphic energy into the composition. Kirchner thinned his paint with benzene to achieve greater fluidity and handling, adding wax to give it a matte finish. I've already noted this quality in Friedrichstrasse, and here in Potsdamer Platz we see the eddies of strokes whirling around the circular traffic island. This dynamic facture is especially striking in Kirchner's third street scene from 1914, Two Women on the Street. Here, too, he dispenses with iconic signifiers of movement, relying instead on the fierce velocity of his brushstroke, like a de Kooning avant la lettre, its force so powerful it seems to distend the features of the woman in orange. As I noted at the beginning of this paper, the representation of movement was an intense preoccupation in the pre-war years. And now in the last part of my paper, I want to situate Kirchner's Berlin paintings in this larger context. The chrono photographs of Marais, which captured bodies in motion a fraction of a second apart, inspired Marcel Duchamp, the futurists, and others to apply this knowledge to the static art of painting. And of course, there was the cinema. Marais probably inspired the French philosopher Henri Bergson, who wrestled with the problem of the relation between movement, perception, and thought in his Creative Evolution, published in 1907. There he observed that the body is changing form at every moment, or rather there is no form, since form is immobile and the reality is movement. What is real is the continual change of form. Form is only a snapshot view of transition. Therefore, our perception manages to solidify into discontinuous images the fluid continuity of the real. Yet Bergson's ultimate model in thinking through this issue was not Marais but cinema, the film strip of still images to which, as he puts it, movement has been added by the apparatus, the cinematograph. I quote, "Take a series of snapshots of a passing regiment and throw these instantaneous views on the screen so that they replace each other very rapidly. This is what the cinematograph does. With photographs, each of which represents the regiment in a fixed attitude, it reconstitutes the mobility of the regiment marching. It is true that if we had to do with photographs alone, however much we might look at them, we should never see them animated. With immobility set beside immobility, even endlessly, we could never make movement. In order that the pictures be animated, there must be movement somewhere. The movement does indeed exist here. It is in the apparatus." Well, Bergson acknowledges that everything is in flux. In this passage of Creative Evolution, he seems to assume that the viewer is passive, immobile. This corresponds to the model adopted a few years later by Duchamp and the Futurists for representing movement. The viewing subject is static. The object is in motion. Duchamp complicated this somewhat with his Sad Young Man on a Train, in which he described two movements, I quote him here, the idea of the movement of the train and then that of the sad young man who is in a corridor and is moving about. Thus, there are two parallel movements corresponding to each other. Nevertheless, while the implied viewer may be moving within the train, his body is presumed to be otherwise static. One wonders if the static position of the cameras that recorded Marais' chronophotographs and the usually fixed camera of early cinema had influenced Bergson's speculations here. For in an earlier book, Matter and Memory of 1896, he had posited an active mobile perceiver whose body acts on the objects perceived. Quote, "I note that the size, shape, even the color of external objects is modified as my body approaches or recedes from them," he writes. "Objects send back then to my body, as would a mirror, its eventual influence. They take rank in an order corresponding to the growing or decreasing powers of my body. The objects which surround my body reflect its possible action upon them." This is an experience conveyed by Robert Delaunay's dynamic, fractured, and ultimately fantastic images of the Eiffel Tower from 1910-11, which seems to be viewed from the jerky, multiple vantage points of someone who has conquered gravity. Here we also find that vertical distension of the viewing field that Kirchner will adopt a few years later. Writing in the 1920s, the German critic Karl Einstein interpreted the cubism of Braque and Picasso as the product of a succession of perceptions of the motif by the artist moving around it in space. But in the case of Delaunay, Braque, and Picasso, the object perceived by the implied mobile subject is essentially static. Okay, I can see that Delaunay's clouds imply movement, but they are not the main motif in those pictures. With Kirchner, on the other hand, what we get is an attempt to represent the movement of the perceiving body in its shifting relation to other moving objects. In pictures that, far from being the immobile snapshots that Bergson saw in the optically static image, vividly evoke the passage through time and space, even as they are contained within a static frame. Both subject and object are in movement. interacting in a nervously charged yet ecstatic dance. And this dynamic interaction distinguishes Kirchner's representation of movement in these Berlin paintings from those of his contemporaries. As the artist himself claimed, this constitutes a high point of his artistic achievement, and to that I would add of early modernism as well. Thank you.